Today's episode of Higher Learning is with Francisco Sorrentino, the Chief People Officer, or maybe Chief Performance Officer, at DigitalBridge Investment. Francisco has worked for some of the biggest companies in the world throughout his career, and he talks about his time at AIG, Microsoft, and IBM, what he's looking for in a potential investment, and how he brings people that fit into the culture of his organization on board. Francisco has so much to share, such great insights, and wonderful stories to tell. I cannot wait for you all to hear this episode. Welcome to another episode of Higher Learning. I am your host, Oz Rashid. Today, we are joined by a very special guest. Today, we are joined by Francisco Sorrentino. He is the CPO at DigitalBridge. How are you doing today, Francisco?
I'm doing well. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So good to see you. I am very excited for this conversation. We had a bit of a pre-conversation. We talked a little bit about your career journey. You've worked at some of the most illustrious brands and organizations in all of business. So I want to dive into that. But at first, I want to start here. I want to learn a little bit about your current role and current firm, DigitalBridge. So I'm interested, first off, as I always am, I want to know why you joined that organization. And then how is being the chief people officer at an investment firm, is it different than maybe your more traditional corporate organizations like IBM and Microsoft, which you've worked at in the past?
So I'll answer the first question. It's interesting. I think it's a bit the reason why I joined DigitalBridge is a bit the intersection of different things I have passion about. One is technology. I've been pretty much my entire career in organizations that, breath technology. They were developing the technology of the future. And I've been in those organizations always in interesting times where maybe the future was being made, right? When IBM, it was about developing the first software business, then data as a power, right? As a weapon. And then SoftBank, the forefront of, investing in the most innovative growth tech companies. And now DigitalBridge is in this interesting intersection between AI and the incredible opportunity we have in front of us with AI, and also all the challenges that AI presents. And one of them, for instance, is power and how you supply power to really feed all this AI development. And this is a firm that invests in companies that are going to make AI evolution possible, and also solving problems that relate to how to make that evolution possible as well, like, for instance, renewable energy. So the company is positioned in an incredible moment in time. And sometimes, you have to be in the right place at the right time. I think DigitalBridge is one of those companies. This is a company that is about to scale or is scaling very rapidly. And then is more than ever paying attention to people and processes and transformation issues, which is something that is obviously my passion. And I think the culture of this company is amazing. It's very entrepreneurial. Very little friction when you compare this to a corporate environment. And I had the opportunity to build a team that is fit for purpose from zero, right? So all those things make this opportunity truly amazing.
Yeah, I think a couple of things that stand out to me about your answer is, number one, entrepreneurship and being successful in entrepreneurship, obviously you got to have an idea. Those are a dime a dozen, okay? The ability to execute and take it to market is the next step and where a lot of people make a lot of success. But I think one of the things that we undervalue is timing and market, right? And if you look at, where technology from early adopters to it becoming, used in a way that is day-to-day and tactical, and the bridge in between those two things, a lot of times technology has been in advance of when consumers were ready for it. I would say that the reason that we're having this moment in AI versus, say, blockchain and metaverse and some of these other virtual reality technologies that have been talked about for the last 5-10 years, the reason AI ultimately is having this moment is because of ChatGPT. The fact that we could put it in customers' hands, they could play with it, ask it questions, get different results than they were used to with a Google search, and then try to figure out all these different applications, that's essentially what has informed, right, all of these businesses, all of these early adopters to start to see the AI gold rush and what's going on right now. And it's been being built into technologies for a long time. But the timing now makes more sense because consumers seem to be more, have a bigger appetite for it, be more ready for it. Whereas blockchain and metaverse and virtual reality and all these things that we've had the technology for a long time, they haven't had that same moment. So I find that to be very interesting. Now, I got to ask, did the DigitalBridge always have an emphasis on AI, or has this been something that has been kind of a renewed focus over the last couple of years with the prevalence of AI and what's going on?
So DigitalBridge is a company that is being for, you know, more than a decade investing in what is called digital infrastructure, data centers, towers, cell towers, fiber. And obviously that it was an enabler for cloud as well, and for all the utilization of the connectivity that comes out of that environment. And now obviously the next frontier is the data centers are at the core of what is the growth of AI. All the processing power that is being built, the grid that is required to transfer that power, you know, from the data centers to the edge, to cars, to mobile devices, to factory robots, et cetera, right? So all that is being built at the moment. And AI, what AI is doing is exponentially growing the amount of data that is required, because the workloads are more and more complex every time. And for that, you need bigger, much, much bigger capacity for processing. You need to transmit faster, you need less latency. There's a number of things that everything that relates to autonomous cars, for instance, as an example, requires a level of proximity to ensure that you have real time, effectiveness. Although, because a microsecond can make a difference between crashing and not crashing, right? So there's so much that is going to be built on the back of having AI. AI presents this opportunity that right now I think we are just scratching the surface a little bit in terms of what is the real potential. There's some things we can see, but many things we can't. So we have been investing in these assets for a long time. Now data centers, you would say, is the star of the show, but also you need, as I said, the mobile towers and the technology that you need to transmit to the edge and from the edge to the devices is also part of the areas in which we invest. So that's really what's why this company is so connected to AI, because it's enabling AI development and growth.
A couple of things. So like the technology sector in general is somewhat down. I know a lot of people are seeing a lot of layoffs, but that is not the case specifically on the hardware side. When you look at NVIDIA, when you look at the ability to house these GPUs and to be able to handle all this mass information and move at speeds previously unseen, that part of the technology sector is booming. When I look at AI in particular, it's funny because we started building our hiring experience software probably about 3 or 4 years ago. And the premise of it has always remained the same. But what I really believed when I was looking at that future roadmap is that AI was a good 3-4 years down the road and would be super expensive, and that we would have to like enable it as time went on. And as soon as obviously things started to break over the last 18 months and it started to democratize the availability of AI, it changed everything. Your feature roadmap goes out the window. You want to stick to your core differentiation, but now you have to be thinking about how generative AI enables and empowers that. And it's par for the course. Like, you have to make sure that you're building things that are AI capable using some of these open source large language models. But also what we've been trying to do is build our own moat, build our own closed large language model that has our data, that takes external data and allows for better outcomes. So it's really exciting time. I think the biggest thing is there's such an uncertainty of it. Where is this going? How fast is it going to go? What is it going to mean? What is it going to mean to technology companies? I'm hearing a lot about how, you know, solopreneurs are going to like develop and be able to build world-class technology with very little resources needed outside of themselves and a computer. How fast is that going to take over? Is that ever going to be the case? I mean, there's just so much going on right now. It's one of the more exciting times I can remember from a technology perspective. And listen,
I think it's the most exciting time. I think it's the most exciting time. And I'll tell you one thing that I don't know if you thought about this, but I find it fascinating. Like in no other times, what I think is beautiful about AI is that if you think about it, the demand is a bit of ahead of the supply in a way, because what it has happened, some people like, the people from ChatGPT, but there's others too, they have made this technology that is extremely complex, and they made it available and understandable and comprehensible to the mass, to the masses. And these masses are playing with it. We're all playing with it. We're experimenting. Some people are going super deep. Some people just using it to, you know, proof an essay or to develop the basis of an essay. But everybody's playing with it. And I think a lot of the where the AI is going is going to be a bit dictated by this demand that is brewing. As you play with it, you start coming up with new ideas on how AI can be useful to you. And you have 8 billion people playing in the planet with AI right now. And I think a lot of the, you know, where the money is going to go, where people want the money to go. So in a way, it is already democratized to the point that maybe dictates a little bit where AI should be going. Now, from a defense point of view, from a financial, you know, how it's going to support governments and financial institutions. And obviously there's big users out there, but there's never been so many people ready to engage with AI. With any other technology, the adoption has been very slow. With this, is massive from the get-go. So that's what's leading to so much investment and so much momentum.
Yeah, I mean, I think the only innovation that we could have even paralleled to it, I think the three biggest innovations of the last 25 years are going to be the internet, cloud technology, and then obviously moving into AI. The internet is the only one I can think of where it's this thing where, but I think even the internet, the technology wasn't mature enough for us to really understand the impact of what's happening. I've never seen something where we all know how big a deal this is, and yet it seems like everybody is scrambling on how to use it. And a lot of people will sound smart and talk like, but I work with a lot of organizations. Most of them, 95%, have zero idea what to do with AI other than knowing that they need to use
That's
it
true.
And need to be a competitive advantage. I've seen consulting firms. I have close friends at these and partners. Yeah. They're building these AI practices to go help these clients who have a demand and are saying, help me with AI. They don't really know what they're doing either. They're trying to FOMO, right? Yeah, of course. There's some we can't not have an AI practice. We can't be doing something with AI. That's a sure way to look like you don't know what you're talking about, what you're doing. And yet nobody really knows how to apply it properly. I've seen some companies obviously building out their own large language models on the internet, on their own intranet. I've seen companies build it into their workflows. But my goodness, like the day-to-day application of it is really, like you said, the demand has really outpaced the ideas of how to leverage it properly. Now, this will change over time. And a lot of it is going to be some of this exciting technology that's being built is going to, like you said, inform the curve of what gets focused on, what gets prioritized, what demands money. So it's just, it feels like the wild, wild west. I'm excited to play a little part in it and I'm excited to be part of it. I'd much rather be, you know, here with my pickaxe in San Francisco in 1849 than I would be sitting on the sideline. But gosh, there's a lot of uncertainty with it
That's right. There is a bit of a gold rush parallel as well. I agree with you. It feels a bit that way.
Someone's going to figure this out. Many are going to figure this out. And I want to be part of that way. But also I want to keep learning because I just think there's so much possibility to come with it. I want to go back to how it's different to work at the investment firm. Now, you are a CPO, which typically means chief people officer, but you told me that it means chief performance officer for you. Can you elaborate on that for me, Francisco?
Yeah, it's funny. And that's the way so when I was introduced to the board, Mark Ganzi, who's the CEO and co-founder of this firm, was introducing me as the chief people officer. And I almost instinctively said, well, really, we should change the P for performance. And everybody loved it and they wanted to do it, right? And I said, no, let's stick to people because it's a bit pretentious. I don't want to set the wrong expectation. But the truth is, I do think this role has the potential to be impactful should be impactful way beyond people. So when you think about my role at DigitalBridge, given where is the firm in terms of scale, you know, in terms of maturity, in terms of ready to scale, I think you need to help the organization grow. You need to make sure the organization is ready in every dimension, right? So there's no problem that really doesn't belong to you let me put it this way. If it is a process problem, it's my problem. If there is a technology problem, if our investors cannot invest because their experience with the technology is bad, it's my problem. If the LPs cannot access the right data or have demands that we cannot meet because they need different sophistication, it's my problem. If we are offering, you know, an employee experience that is very different country to country, office to office, it's my problem, right? If we have a marketing issue because we go to the market or conferences not with the right intention, not with the right focus, it's my problem. So everything that this company doesn't do well is in a way my problem. It's the CEO's problem and he needs to worry about it. My job is to fix it. So I cannot just worry about it, right? So one of us can just worry about it. One of us needs to fix it, right? So, and the idea is to bring on board the people that can really fix these problems or can help us I'm not saying we're doing poorly or we have issues in all these places. In some places, we have marginal improvements to make. In some places, like in HR, for instance, I think we were very delayed. And we are now catching up very quickly with the 22nd century, right? So if thinking, for instance, on how to introduce AI were applicable. But more importantly, 100% focused on employee experience, right? Employees are customers for us. And when you think about that, it's everything that needs to go well for employees to have a flawless experience. But anyways, we've been focusing on attracting the right talent, building the right structure for the organization, thinking about how we want to look like when we grow up, and investing heavily on transformation resources, on technology resources, systems, etc. So I work very closely with the COO, very closely with the CTO. And we are really a team of three, and there's very few things we can do by ourselves, really, because we have a lot of interdependency. So that's why the concept of performance comes from.
Here's why I love it, and here's how I kind of frame it in my head as you say it. People are at the center of everything we do at every business. I famously say, or not very famously, but in my relative group of people who listen to me talk, we're all financial services, retail, automotive, those are all people. Based companies, right? It's people who build the tractors, that build the cars, that build the process. And so when you say that there's a problem with the process, there's usually one of two issues. Either the person who created the process was wrong, or there's some sort of human impediment in the process that's causing a problem. Same thing with technology. We had people build the technology. That's what it'll be, at least for the foreseeable future, I think, right? Or there's some sort of man-made issue or flaw that we didn't see. So when it comes to people, they are the reason our businesses perform or not. And these other things are somewhat outputs or ancillary to what they're doing. And so, yeah, of course, you are worried about the performance of the entire business. And if you've got to empower people, put the right things in place for people to do their best work and their productivity, then your hands are all across that organization in terms of its success or failure. And that's why I love that framing. And if you don't mind, I might steal it. I might say, hey, listen, I'm the chief performance officer here.
Go ahead. It's all about sharing. We are in a sharing economy and a sharing society. So
sure. I love it. So listen, I want to go back through your career a little bit. I know you've worked for many, like we talked about, well-recognized brands and organizations. They're known for innovation, known for great talent. I want to go through four of them. I want to ask you what you took away from each culture that has maybe informed your core philosophy on culture or how you show up as a leader. Okay. So let's start here. IBM. What'd you take away from IBM?
So IBM, I would say, was my university in a way. And I think it was management, leadership, and respect. There was one value that I remember at IBM that was the one that stuck with me, and it's the most important one in my opinion, which is personal accountability on every relationship. Mm. That means relationship with the coworkers, vendors, clients, partners, etc. Right? So. And you could breathe that at IBM. There was a level of commitment to transparency, commitment to professionalism, and there were no shortcuts. So go the long way and it's the right way. And everybody was doing that. And for me, it was an amazing learning early in my career, because then what I had to do is to learn how to go faster, but I knew how to do it in the right way. And I think that was the biggest learning.
You built a lot of the foundational principles that made you who you are at IBM. And it's funny because that first career choice or early in our career, those companies can make us or break us in terms of the way we see corporate America, the way we see people, how we value things. Sounds like IBM was a great place for you to kind of kick off.
That's amazing.
Career. What about Microsoft?
Microsoft, it was about challenging the status quo. When Satya Nadella joined us he was at Microsoft. He's a long timer. But when he took the job of the CEO, he truly, truly transformed the company, but he challenged every principle. He truly transformed the culture from a know-it-all to learn-it-all. And it's very easy to say, it could be even put in a bumper sticker, but I can tell you doing it is really, really hard. And for me, it taught me the value of consistency. And I think the way you change an organization, you change a culture, you build a culture, you sustain it is about consistency. So you have to be consistent to what you say and do it day after day. And the other thing is, from Microsoft, I learned also a lot about respect, but in a different way. I think Microsoft made me a better leader. Satya is a very inspirational, very deep individual. He anchored the leaders on this basically three principles. That is, your job as a leader is to generate energy, create clarity, and deliver results. And you cannot do one of them. You need to do the three of them. It's like the three legs of the stool. And when you think about these three things, that is exactly what you need to do as a leader. And if you do only two of them, it's a necessary condition, but not sufficient. So that way of equipping managers with these principles and then basing all the performance management, the reward system around it, it was what really led to Microsoft to do what it's doing today, which is crushing the market because they're really killing it. I wouldn't have thought, nobody believed that Microsoft was going to be doing what it's doing today back then. But seeing that leadership team set the foundation, I am not surprised about seeing what Microsoft is doing.
I'm a big NBA fan, so I see a lot of Steve Ballmer. I hear a lot of him. Amazing job of, he enriched himself quite a bit and smartly bet on himself and did some good things while at Microsoft. You know, I've talked to a lot of people there, and I think sometimes he gets a little undersold in terms of some of the things he did bring to the table. But my God, Satya Nadella has just done an incredible job of taking to a company that got very static and stale to a degree to what it is now from a market cap perspective and how they transform themselves. I love this. Generate energy, deliver clarity, drive results. Is that correct?
Yes.
The management, yeah. That is so good. Well, I got to ask a question. When you went from this kind of knowing mentality, and I know exactly what you mean when you said that, knowing mentality, the learning mentality, and you were in HR, did you have any kind of specific role in that on the change management of that? Because like you said, it's very easy to state that in a State of the Union address, right, to the company, yeah. But like to actually like live that and change that culture, what did you have to do?
Well, I mean, the good news is, and in part, that's why I joined Microsoft, HR was at the center of this change. And I do think Microsoft has a very, very good HR function and great people working there. I think HR in Microsoft has a very good mentality and also they were also part of the change and spearheading some of the change. So just to give you an example, I mean, almost like 50% of the leaders were changed one way or the other, right? The focus went from certain products to the cloud. So not to go into too much detail, but HR had to retrofit the company with a very different type of seller because our sellers were selling products that now needed a very, very, I mean, we were now starting to sell cloud, conversations that were from product to strategic. It required to be no more in the basement talking to the IT guys, but talking to the CEO and the CFO and the chief transformation officers. And it required to buy very different talent and to equip our team very quickly with new tools because you couldn't really replace the whole organization. So there was a mix of new way of leading the team, a new way of equipping the team and hiring new people. So and everything happened really, really fast because Satya knew that the window was very narrow. So he needed to act very fast. So we had calls every week to talk about cloud engineers hiring, for instance, or cloud architects hiring, or people that would be the customer success leaders, all roles that we had very little or were new in the organization. So there were entirely new functions of people being built and being hired. So it was a massive experience. Everyone really, coalesced around that agenda very nicely, in part for the work of the HR team did. So I think the HR team has a lot of, to do with the success of Microsoft in that transition.
I love that. What about AIG? What did you take away from AIG?
AIG, I mean, you learn from the good things and the bad things, no? In AIG, I learned about the power of resiliency a little bit and how to, in a way, it's funny. Let me give you an analogy. You get out of a really, really close one, right? Let's say you are sick and you fear for your life. And then when you're about, you're in those moments, you promise yourself that you're going to eat better and live better and kiss your friends and this and that. And then you're on the other side, now you recover, and then 3 months later, just doing the same thing, right? So that's for me AIG, right? A company that could have that moment to become much, much better and renew the talent. They didn't renew anything. They basically kept doing what they were doing. And they I think they were an extremely relevant firm. And I think they misused an opportunity. So there was too much politics in my, but it was great to see that side of the business as well. So it's not a place that I learn a lot or I enjoyed, but I feel like it was an extremely good experience from from that perspective.
You know, wow, that's such an interesting take. And from the outside and from the results, you can kind of see that that's what happened. But it's like you said, it's, you know, we come to these moments where things are touch or go. And what I always tell people here at MSH, you know, we're going to make mistakes. We're in a people business. It's not easy. It can be very tough. You're going to fight adversity. But every time something goes wrong, it's an opportunity to rewrite a new happy ending. And I really believe that. Like every time somebody makes a really big mistake, you have an opportunity to go fix that in such a way that when they talk about your mistake, there's no way that they can't bring up the way that you handled it and fixed it and made it better. And it just sounds like for the AIG that did not happen. It sounds like they had one of their reckoning came to their doorstep, right? Survived by the skin of their teeth, and then didn't actually take it to make themselves better going forward. They'd only continued to hasten a potential downfall is really the only other way to put it. So
it's funny when you realize something is not exactly right with an organization, maybe from a business perspective or strategy or culture, when you see really good people leaving, the people that everybody says, to work with that person is sort of the future of the firm, and that person suddenly walks out of the door, starts to create this feeling like something is not going in the right direction because those voices are trusted and those intellects are respected, and you cannot have that situation. No matter how much it's going to cost you, you need to bet on those people, not let them walk out of the
door. Those are the people that are the solution. They're not the problem, and that's a real deep sign that your culture has gone wayward and that you probably need to do something quickly to get that turned around. What about a SoftBank?
SoftBank, I loved every minute. It was, I think is where I would say the concept that defines SoftBank, and in a way also DigitalBridge, is a no friction environment, which is we are all very clear about what are we trying to do. The world of investments is very, very clear in that way. I mean, we are here to, fundraise and give our LPs the best possible return, right? Or put it in other ways, to make money and to make good decisions around investments. And when you are in such a simple world, in a way, I mean, everyone that relates to that equation is extremely clear. There's the role you have is undeniably valuable, or it shouldn't exist. In many organizations in corporate, you have a lot of roles that struggle finding what's the value equation, what you bring, what happens if you are not showing up the next day and sometimes nothing happens, right? Or for a number of days, or sometimes for a year. In this organization, like SoftBank, we were building a very specific machine, and everyone in that organization was very much clear about the purpose we had, the mission that we had, and things moved really fast. But in a way, it's the opposite of corporate. Your area of incompetence is very visible, and your area of competence is very visible, because it's one conversation, one purpose, and either you have something to contribute or not. So it becomes a very, very simple environment in terms of determining whether you fit or don't fit. And also your hiring is very intentional. So so those organizations are very entrepreneurial in a way. There aren't really many conversations that are about ideas or opinions. It's more about facts, very data-driven. The failing is very common, and the regrouping and moving on, having a goldfish memory, let's say, right? Learning, but not getting stuck and moving on and keep iterating. And the decisions are not yours or mine, are ours. And when we commit, we do. And we stand by our decision. In corporate, it's very common to find the guilty person and the finger pointing, right? So very different, very, very different. In my opinion, everything gets in your life at the right time. So perhaps I found SoftBank, or SoftBank found me at the right time. maybe 10 years ago, it would have been a complete no or a failed experience. But I guess it was the right time for me and the right place. But I loved every minute.
Yeah, I got to ask you, just because I'm kind of a nerd when it comes to organizational structure. So investment firms and VCs are typically run very lean, right? You're obviously deploying your capital to potential, funds or invest or things you want to invest in. How big was the employee base that you were actually responsible for as chief human resources officer?
No, these firms don't have a huge employee footprint. SoftBank back then was about 500 okay. people. DigitalBridge today is about 300.
Yeah.
But the complexity, first of all, I always say to my teams, both in SoftBank and DigitalBridge, we are not catering clients in McDonald's, like 40, 50, a million a day. It's a Michelin-star restaurant, right? So the way of thinking of complexity is very different. The depth of your practice, what you do for people, how you do for people becomes a much more customized exercise. The needs of these people are much more complex as well. So, and then there is the internal front and there is the portfolio front, which is something very interesting as well, how you enable your portfolio teams to perform better as well. So not just the internal clients, but the portfolio as well. There is a lot of data. You are very rooted on data and everything you do. So, you have to be on top of what is a market practice and what is not, and creating the, there's no detail. Like, again, back to the Michelin star restaurant, the scent in the restaurant, how the hostess or the host is dressed, the color of the tablecloth, every detail is tailored and is curated to create an experience. I'm not suggesting that this is what we do, but we need to think that way. So it takes a lot more bandwidth. You couldn't do that for 300,000 people like you have in someone's.
That analogy makes total sense to me. I'm interested. I want to ask you, because you've been involved with investment. You sat through lots of pitches throughout your career. I'm interested, you in particular, maybe, or maybe some of the cohorts that you work with. What are you looking for in a company, a founder, when making an investment? And then what are maybe some of the red flags or indicators of success looking at it from another perspective?
Well, I mean, you touched on this. It's funny enough. The team, it was the number one thing. Remember that when I started my journey with SoftBank, it was kind of the beginning of the hype of this venture capital investment. So it was a lot of money being thrown at people, and there was very little time to sometimes analyze the investment per se and due diligence on the teams. And we started looking into, we need to spend more time on the teams. We need to really understand who these guys are. We need to really get to hear more detail about their plans. Some of the hypotheses we had around the business thesis were grounded on, a couple of things like geographic expansion or launching a product or certain market share. And we needed to look into, okay, who is going to do that, right? Let's talk to that person. Let's spend time. Let's hear that person think. How deep is the thinking? How deep is the knowledge of that market? And every investment, we realized it was going to break or make based on the people that we were talking to. Because the people we're going to talk to are the people that were going to manage the investment for the next 5 years, for sure. There was no plan to kind of, we were not investing to re-engineer the team or to replace people. That is the team that is going to take us from 5 million to 500 million. Is that possible? Are they really going to do that? So it all becomes about the trust and the confidence that you get to develop on the team during that process, no?
I love that. And I've heard that from everybody, that the founder, the team that they have in place, their knowledge of what they're doing. Maybe I'm making too big of a leap here, but like, does that give in both SoftBank and a DigitalBridge, does that give HR, people operations, a little bit more of a outsized influence or point of view? And what I mean by that is the ability to read people and understand people and get the most out of people and maximize people is something that is very inherent to making sound investments, as well as hiring and developing and retaining people. Do they make that correlation at all? Do you see that correlation, or am I totally coming out of left field?
Yeah, I would say it's an opportunity that we certainly embraced at SoftBank, and we are embracing at DigitalBridge. Now, the funny thing is, the fact that it's a people matter doesn't mean necessarily it's an HR matter, because many HR organizations are not very well equipped with people that is intuitive, or they can read people, or they know what good looks like. So this is the problem when you are underinvested in HR. HR cannot play that role. But if you overinvest, which I think is the right thing to do in HR, you get people that give you the edge, right? Because right now, when I'm thinking about Digital Bridge, for example, the investors are not HR people, but they're super smart. And they know people, and they can read people. For instance, and Mark, the CEO, is an extremely intuitive guy. I mean, I can tell you, I mean, it's impressive. Now, they may not have the method, they may not have the process acumen that a person in HR has, but these guys are extremely insightful when it comes to talent. And they know the field of expertise. So when you combine that with a good HR function that, you know, can weaponize all that by establishing a good process, a good partnership with them, is much better than having just a good HR function or just a good people, because it's that capability augmented multiple times. So, but we need to make sure that we find the way to do it is scalable, right? Doing it once is not going to make it. You have to do it 10 times, 100 times, and have a method and have a practice, which is, that's what I'm trying to build with the team.
Yeah, I think we got a
repetitive, a recipe.
A recipe. Chef Francisco over here. I think we got a great tagline here. Great people helping you get and build more great people. That's what a good HR organization does. I love that.
I love it.
All right. We got to pay the bills here. So we want to talk about hiring. I know that you have evaluated investors throughout your career, or investment opportunities throughout your career. You've helped build these organizations. You've been in some of the biggest brands. So I want to start here. Do you personally have a core hiring philosophy for anyone that you want to bring into your team or bring into your organization?
Yeah, I mean, deep into my practice, if I need to find a pattern, because you interview people perhaps in different stages in life, in career, right? So for different reasons, purposes. But I look for clarity. I look for clarity, and that's my pattern. I realize that I need to understand how clearly the person is thinking about opportunity at the end of the day, how much of a self-awareness there is in terms of why this is a good match, how well the person understands the opportunity, you know, their traits, and how this marriage between what you can bring to the table and what the organization is trying to do. So that clarity for me is fundamental, because I can test and ask questions about the past, and you're going to tell me you did amazing things, and I can ask you about skills, and of course you have amazing skills. And the premise in my mind is, I don't talk to people that is not extraordinary. I mean, I'm already talking to some. If I'm talking to someone, that someone is really good. So I'm not trying to test if you're good or bad. I'm trying to understand why this is a good idea. And most of the time, I realize that it's easier for me to help somebody hire themselves than me thinking I'm hiring someone. Because at the end of the day, you're not hiring. You are helping someone make a good decision. And that decision can be, I'm going to drop this, right? So winning not always is hiring the person. Winning is sometimes, you know, parting ways at the right time in the process.
I love that because I think what we forget a lot of times, it's always the organization hiring the individual. The individual is making a commitment and decision most of the time, a much bigger one as the company. And them understanding what their why, it does you no good to paint something that it's not, to get somebody in the door only to have them be unsatisfied or unfulfilled in the role. I think that is really, really good advice. Let me jump to this question then. What do you do to convey what it's going to be like to work at SoftBank or DigitalBridge? I have to imagine these are high performance, data-driven type environments that take a special type of person to be successful there. How do you convey that, right, in the interview? So they're not just looking at the name on the door, but they're understanding what it's like to work at the company and assess if that's the right fit for them.
Well, in a way, it's all about the right storytelling. And like any story, you have to have a cohesive approach to it. And some people may be more interested in jumping straight to the end. Some people may want to, you know, stay more time in the introduction. But at the end of the day, you need to talk about, you know, from outside in, let's say, right? So why this business is not just viable, but very promising, right? What's happening in the landscape, right? Some people need more information about that. Some people are already very well informed. So you don't need to go there. But for instance, if you're hiring people in HR, in finance, in compliance, those functions are not, sometimes you're not hiring people from the industry. So people that are working in firms that are not related to investment world, right? So you need to explain a bit more that. So people need to understand why this organization is a good place to place a bet for the next 3 to 5 years. Then you need to talk a little bit about the philosophy on how we do business and how we work as a team, right? I mean, how we roll every day. I mean, how is our interaction? What's our maturity? Again, back to the honesty, back to the transparency. You're not going to find everything in the right place, but you're going to help us build it. You're going to help us make it better. We welcome feedback. And I give also this piece of information. I say, we've made X amount of hires. None of them has left. And all of them have been rated in the last performance cycle, like strong performers or better. Meaning people are landing well, people are staying, and people are thriving. So why? Because this is a firm that we are growing and we need the talent. So you tell a little bit about the culture, the way of working. Then you start talking about the particulars, you know, the particulars around the area that you're hiring for and what's happening there and what's interesting that we're building there and what's going to be your role in helping us build that and whether you can do it or not. And so we need to build a practice of telling people that we are under construction, right? So people need to bring a helmet, need to bring the tools and help us with the dust and be comfortable with that. And we're going to be in construction for a while because we are a fast growing company. Then we can get into the details of the hygienic things, right? But I think for the most part, what people get really excited about is being in a place where they can see themselves winning and they see projection, right? Not a firm that is trying to just do good or just to make a profit or just, you know, and delivering, I don't know, 10 cents of earnings per share. It's the type of business we do is very exciting for some people and it's very uninteresting for some people. So you need to make sure that you talk to the right crowd, no? And that's why it's not always. And the other thing I would say is important is to have partners that help you tell your story in a way that is true to how we think is the story should be told. Like sometimes agencies or headhunting firms, search firms, they're just not equipped with the right storytelling, and you don't have the right, you know, marketing, and you find people in your interviews that shouldn't be here in this conversation, right? So, I think getting that right is very important as well.
You just teed me up, and so I talk to our customers
saw your face.
All the time.
I saw you were
prepared. Get excited because you get it, right, Francisco, and that doesn't happen that often. So I just thought, yeah, I'm definitely excited about it. We talk to clients all the time, and then some of them work with 10 vendors, right? And if you're working with 10 vendors, then it's likely that there's 10 different messages about your company going out into the market, right? And if you're a company of any type of size, especially in your home community, that's going to impact their interaction with those recruiters at the end of the day are going to impact how people view your company, good or bad. And if they're not an extended wing of your organization, if they don't know your organization like your people do, then you're doing yourself a real disservice. And now some will say, well, that's why it's better to internalize. There's a lot of flaws and issues with that as well. You have to have the right partner is what it really comes down to. And I've always said, and I think you're going to agree with me on this, I actually look at talent acquisition as marketing, right? I've said this before, but you're taking a great company and role and marketing it out to the world to get them excited to want to be part of it. And then when you have the right candidate, you're marketing it back to the hiring team and saying, this is why I think this person's a great fit. And you're trying to understand that fit and that match. And ultimately, when I look at marketing and the resources it gets, right, to invest in cost of acquisition of customer or lifetime value of a customer, but we're not doing that on the HR side. You said it earlier, like, I think it should be invested in, there should be more resources put in, and I totally agree. And so for me, like, we don't let anybody work on any of our clients until they pass a test on training that they understand, like, certain qualities of the organization, like revenue, CEO, mission, vision, all that good stuff, because we're helping define that employee value proposition that articulates to the community, and the community wants to hear it all along the way, every step of the way, that it's consistent and validated. Otherwise, they raise an eyebrow, it hurts candidate experience. So you get it. You understand it. It's super important. I wish others did, one person at a time. I might have to bring them all onto the pod, but that is a really, really important way to look at things. And I'm so glad you said it. I want to ask you this. Do you have a favorite question that you like to ask in interviews? Is there one that you've been using for a long time, or one that you find you get the most insightful answers?
Well, you wouldn't be surprised, but my question is, what's your why? No? What's your why? And the other one is, what's your vision for this role? And these two questions can unpack a lot of things. But most importantly, unpack the lack or the existence of clarity, right? Because there aren't really many ways you can answer the why. The why is authentic, right? So it's why you think it's a good idea. And how you answer that question gives a lot of information, and also the vision. So, okay, you've talked to all these many people. What do you think you can do for us in this role? What's your vision? What would you like to do with this piece of land, right, that we give you? And those two questions are very open-ended questions. And for me, are the questions that carry the most value in terms of knowing if someone is right for the job.
All right, well, let's play the game. What's your why, Francisco?
My why for this, the rich?
For why you do the work you do.
Well, I do the work I do because I think there is so much opportunity for HR and the world of HR, and it's so underutilized at the moment. And I feel like, you know, one day at a time, I'm gonna, you know, make my contribution to put HR in a different place. I think the potential that is to be unpacked, to be untapped in this world of HR is massive, and I see it every day. So you need to find the place where, you know, you can make your ideas flourish. The place that is obviously not surrounded by people trying to keep the status quo or try to maintain things as they are. But when you see an opportunity for transformation, the amount of work and impact that HR can make is huge. So I think it's...
And I'll do what I do. I'll answer the question as well. Legacy is really important to me. And I think when I drive it back down to its roots, it's that I want to leave, whenever I leave this world, I want to have made an imprint. I want to have made an impact. I want to leave things better off. I don't want to have just, you know, existed and then moved on and then not done something that was profound and unique and different. And so a lot of my life was found navigating, where do I think I can make an impression? Where is there an opportunity? I've had four kids. And so leaving them in a place where they can make an impact will certainly fulfill that vision. But for me, it just comes down to wanting to do something that matters, wanting to do someone, wanting to, you know, seeing something that's not working or fundamentally broken and doing my part to try to fix it and make it better. And so I believe, you know, I'm not motivated by money because I think money is a byproduct of doing something great, right? I think that if I focus on as doing as much good as possible, both at home and at work, then I'll have done something and I can feel good about, you know, my time on this earth. And so when I wake up in the morning, it's about leaving something lasting and building something that's sustainable. So.
And you said something really interesting, which is, I do think that I'm convinced and I've seen endless examples of when you are passionate about something, it's very likely you're going to do it very well. And it's very likely you're going to make money, right? But it's not fun. It's not easy to find something you're passionate about. So it's, instead of looking for the money, you need to really look at what moves your energy, right? Mm-hmm. What are the things that really move your energy? And then you, the byproduct of that, to your point, is going to be making money. The problem is, going for the money, it will not guarantee the success.
No, sure. You won't feel fulfilled long enough, because especially once you get it, then you're like, what's next? And then you're chasing something else. I think the Japanese call it a kaji. It's the confluence of things you're good at, things that you're passionate about, and things that you can do well enough to support yourself and live in. So if you can find kind of that wheelhouse, that's what it is. And so I feel good about that I've done that, but I've got a lot of work to do to continue to kind of build on what I want to build. So my why. That's what gets me up in the morning. Last hiring question. If I ask you for a memorable interview experience, does any come to mind?
Well, in terms of me, I mean, to be honest, as an interviewer, I had many memorable, but no one particular that really would, I would say, stand out as a crazy interview, as a memorable, as a candidate. I think my interview when I was meeting Marcelo Claure when I was joining SoftBank, it was probably one of the most. I remember being, I think it was midnight, in a hotel. He was just flying from I don't know where with a crazy schedule. I think he was just meeting the FIFA president. I think trying to organize a club's international cup or something like that. And he was telling me about all the things that he was doing in his day. And I was coming from, you know, a corporate environment thinking, but my day only has 24 hours, right? So how he can fit so many things. His pace was incredible. I mean, he was describing a world that was completely foreign to me and almost like it felt like Alice in Wonderland. And I look back and I'm thinking, I was in a completely different place in my life. And that interview was an eye opener for me. It was kind of the first time I talked to someone that is like, I don't even know how can I get to comprehend what this person is saying, right? The speed,
operating
the complexity.
In a different level.
And then you catch up little by little, right? It's like you throw yourself in the pool, you start swimming one stroke at a time.
Well, I think the lesson there is run with people faster than you, because first you might be behind, but then you're going to learn to keep pace or keep as close a pace as you can, and that'll make you better in the long run. So
absolutely, yeah, you need to run with people that run faster than you and that have a good culture, a good working culture. And I think you need to, for me, the number one rule is avoid toxicity anywhere you can. Doesn't matter how much they pay. Doesn't matter, you know, how are they called? Avoid toxicity, and you need to learn how to identify it and stay away from it. Because in a non-toxic environment, anything is possible. That's the reality.
Mm.
In a toxic
and
environment,
I think that works for your home life too. If you have toxic things in your personal life or home life, get those out of there, because you're not going to be able to do your best work.
Absolutely.
I'm with you. What's something you're working on right now that you're very excited about, Francisco?
Well, right now we are working on two things. One is as I told you, the employee experience is a philosophy, it's a concept that something is very important for us, but we're working on developing, you know, that value proposition in a way that we can almost package it and make it happen. Like we're thinking about what are the moments of the truth, as we call it. What is the moments that employees experience, the offering that we have, what are the things they care about, like what type of conversations they have at year end about performance, how they experience, how are we managing the work capacity for the investment team, what tools are we giving them, how are they, what is their experience with the benefit providers that we have, so anything, right? So we're looking comprehensively at everything that touches the employee and working on make sure that, listen, it's not going to be perfect from day one, but it's going to be intentional from day one. So we were trying to make it to go from accidental to intentional, right? The first thing. And then as we gain control over what's happening, the most important thing is to define accountability, right? There's always going to be one person that is accountable and make sure that person understands the value of feedback. It's not escaping feedback, but embracing feedback. And then, so employee experience is number one. I'm obsessed with that. And the other one is to really structure an approach to support the portfolio companies. In a way that, because I always believe that these things need to be done in a very organic way. So finding out what is the dynamic around the portfolio, what are the characteristics of the companies, what are the particular moment and the needs that that particular portfolio has, and start thinking about, okay, what solutions can be delivered in a relatively scalable way. So those are the two fronts that I'm, and to be honest, if you asked me this question 6 months ago, I would have told you I'm building my team. Now I build my team. I'm very happy with the team I have, and that's what is going to really make it possible.
That's about maximizing.
Without a team, you're just a man.
Exactly. When I learned that the power of 10 is more powerful than the power of one, that was game changing for my career. I realized that all my efforts didn't have to go into making myself
Absolutely.
The best possible individual. It's about building a high performing team and building a structure where they can do their best work, and that is worth its weight in gold. I'm getting ready to take a plane flight pretty soon, so I'm asking this for myself as much as I am for the other listeners. Do you have a recent book you've read or any type of content you consume that you want to share that's good?
I don't read business really anything, but I actually read this book that I am fascinated with. It's called Hail Mary, and it's written by Andrew Weir. I think I think that the. I hate butchering names, but W-E-I-R, I think, is his last name. He's a software engineer.
What's it about?
It's a fiction. It's a fiction novel. It's all about tech and science. It's about I don't want to tell you, but you need to read it. It's about it's really about interstellar travel. But
okay,
I can
like the
tell
movie,
you,
like I've seen the movie Interstellar. It's similar to that.
The beauty of this is the amount of data and specifics that this person provides, and how the problem solving, and the way it's described, and how the solutions work, and there's alien life involved. A very, very crazy book, but it's so well written. I loved it. I loved it. It's if you're a bit geek, into tech, into problem solving, into it's super smart book. Super smart book. It really gets your brain working. Very stimulating.
That's the whole
Hail
reason I
Mary.
Read. I want to be stimulated. I want to be entertained. I want to change the way I think. So that book sounds.
And I'll tell
like
you
a
this.
Really
I'll tell you this, and I don't want to spoil it, but the problem that they're trying to resolve or address in the story is fascinating. It's very innovative, I would say.
Okay.
Very
I'm going to
creative.
check that out. I like
Yeah.
that. Last question, Francisco.
Yes.
If you had one bit of advice to offer your 20-year-old self that you didn't know then, but you know now, what would it be?
Career-wise, I mean, life-wise, I would say it's the same thing. No, well, when you're younger, you are a bit more self-centered, and you're starting to grow your self-awareness, right? And I'm giving you this preface. If I could give one advice, I would say be more generous and be more helpful from day one. It pays off. It's probably the best investment you can make. Help others. Try to do everything you can not to be self-centered. It goes a long way.
I love that. That is great advice. Francisco, listen, we've taken up our time. You were an amazing conversation. I appreciate the discussion.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming on. I know this is going to be an episode that everybody loves, and I can't wait for everybody to hear it. Thanks again.
Really, thank you for having me. It was a pleasure, and I'm sure we're going to be talking soon.
All right, Francisco. Thanks so much.